This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, good evening, everyone. I'm very excited and honored to be teaching you this evening. I'm going to be presenting the fruits of a course I taught at Matan, actually, in the course of last year, on the intersect between Kvod HaBriot, human dignity, and Psak Halacha, halachic decision-making, and where the two intersect. Because as we're going to discover, the understanding that man is created in the image of God, but man is also very much bound by his body, is very much limited by his body, and that situations of bodily discomfort or bodily degradation can get in the way of serving God, is one of the pieces we're gonna explore, and we're gonna then going to expand it to the idea that people can be embarrassed or lose their dignity when it comes to their relationships with one another within a religious system. And so we're going to be looking at some very fascinating examples and test cases, and where we're going to end up is to see whether we can expand some of what we develop in the course of the next hour to unprecedented situations to see if halacha can incorporate an idea, a concept, a teaching, a principle, and take it to places where it's never been taken. So I want to start off with is the idea that man is created in the image of God. Take a look at Pirkei Avot, the first source on your page. Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tselem. This idea, Rabbi Akiva would say, beloved is man, for he was created in the image of God. It is a sign of even greater love that it has been made known to him that he was created in the image. As it says, for in the image of God he made man. Rabbi Akiva starts off and he's talking about all mankind. He's not talking about the children of Israel. We're going to get to the Jewish people. But when we talk about human dignity, we're talking about the dignity of man, woman, big and small, regardless of race and religion, of gender. And we were all created in the image of God, and for that reason we are beloved. And then he narrows it to beloved are Israel. But it's important to notice that he starts out, there's something unique in the creation of man, because man, when I say man, I mean man and woman, mankind, was created in the image of God. The second source I want to look at to build on that idea is Ben Azai, who says, Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam. They're having an argument in Bereishit Rabbah, in Genesis Rabbah. Genesis Rabbah is a rabbinic interpretation that dates back to 450 CE. It's really the first rabbinic interpretation to write a commentary on particularly the book of Genesis. One of the things I stress when I teach Midrash, a rabbinic interpretation, there is no one right answer. There is no one way to interpret biblical text. And in this case, they're arguing over the most important principle. What do you need to know in order to be a good person? What's the greatest principle the Torah has to teach us? And many of you will say, I know, because I learned in Hebrew school or day school, or the rabbi told me, v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. Wrong. According to Ben Azai, you're wrong. Because Ben Azai didn't agree with Rabbi Akiva. It turns out Rabbi Akiva was only one voice in the conversation. Ben Azai says something else. Ben Azai says the most important principle of the Torah is that we were created in the image of God, and the verse he brings is chapter 5, verse 1 in Genesis. B'yom bara Elokim Adam b'dmut Elokim asa oto. Zek klal gadol b'torah. The most important principle is that God created man, male and female, in his image. And that is what you need in order to live your life. That is the greatest principle of the Torah. Rabbi Akiva then comes and says, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, you shall love your neighbor like yourself. And Rabbi Tanchuma wraps up that conversation by saying, if you do so, if you do shame someone, know whom you put to shame, in the likeness of God made he him. Rabbi Tanchum really comes and Rabbi Tanchuma comes and synthesizes between Rabbi Akiva and Ben Azai. But what I'm trying to develop in the first two sources is there is something unique about the creation of man, man being created in the image of God, that distinguishes mankind from the rest of God's creations and confers upon him automatically a meaning to his life, something that he's supposed to incorporate into his life, both in his relationship to mankind, in relationship to the world, in relationship to God. So what we see here is that there is something awesome in the creation of mankind, in the creation of man and woman. We are created in the image of God. And the question is, how is that going to connect to the way the challenges that come upon us as we live our life, as we, you know, try to submit ourselves to the will of God, to the will of society? Rambam takes it in an interesting direction as the last piece of the first section. Rambam, when he warns judges as to how they're supposed to judge, says something very important. He talks about the fact that all of his deeds, of the judge's deeds, should be for the sake of heaven and the honor of people. Why? Because al yeh kvod habriyot kal be'einav. The honor of people at large should not be light in his eyes. This idea that the dignity of the people standing in front of a judge should never be far from his consideration. And what's fascinating about kvod habriyot, let's take a minute. Kvod has to do with honor, dignity. That's not an egalitarian definition. If we talk about honor, the honor I give to a child is not the honor that I give to an adult. The honor I give to someone who works a more, say, the kind of profession, a street cleaner, is not usually the honor I give to a surgeon. Meaning honor, by its definition, is not egalitarian. And yet, what we're going to see, what Rambam says, and we're going to see developed in the next hour, this idea of kvod habriyot, taking a non-egalitarian term and imposing upon something completely egalitarian, creation, creatures, the idea that we were all created in the image of God, is a fascinating juxtaposition. And what are we going to do with it? All creatures are deserving of kavod. All creatures, when I say creatures, I mean humans, okay, mankind. We're not going to start, you know, tonight we're not going to deal with, you know, animals and people and their relationship, but we're talking about mankind, this idea of kvod habriyot, a non-egalitarian term juxtaposed to an egalitarian term. And Rambam says when people stand before a judge in court, a judge can never ignore this idea of kvod habriyot, human dignity. Why? Because, as we'll see, he says something that I'm about to develop in the next section. The consideration of their honor, of human dignity, overrides the observance of a rabbinic prohibition. Now, I'm going to explain that more in detail, and I'm going to see where the Talmud takes us. But this idea that judges in particular have to give honor to everyone who walks into their courtroom because of kvod habriyot, because all of mankind was created in the image of God, is a very important principle. And it's an important principle. It's an important educational statement. The question is, what does it have to do with legal practice? Can I codify laws based on something like dignity and honor or lack of dignity, shame? What does that have to do with legal code? Turn the page, please. As we move our way from an ethical statement, from Ben Azai, who thinks the most important principle you can live by is remembering that everyone's created in the image of God, or Rambam, who reminds judges that every person who steps into the courtroom must be treated with respect and with dignity because of a principle, great is human dignity, we're going to see where that idea first appears in the Talmud. It appears actually in an unusual place. It appears in the Tosefta of Bava Kamma. So we're talking here about criminal law. We're talking about theft. We're going to talk about the fact that when a man steals an animal, he has to pay fourfold or fivefold restitution. That's based on the Torah. If you steal a cow, you need to pay fivefold restitution. If you steal a sheep, you pay fourfold restitution. Okay? And that's in the Torah. That's a biblical law. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, in the second paragraph, says here, Bo ureh kamachas hamakom al kvod habriyot. It's the first time this is being used legally. He's giving a reason for the difference between fourfold restitution of a sheep and fivefold restitution of an ox or a cow. And he says, come and see how great is human dignity. Come and see how God had compassion on the dignity of his creatures. Why? Sure, mimnei shemahalech beraglo mishalem chamisha. When you steal an ox, you cannot lift the ox up or the cow up. You pull the ox, and the ox then follows you. And you pay fivefold restitution. But when you steal a sheep, when you steal a sheep or a goat, you can sling it over your shoulders and walk away. And there's something funny about thinking about the thief slinging the sheep over its shoulders. but you degrade yourself. In the moment that you steal a sheep and degrade yourself, sacrifice your human dignity, says Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Torah actually acknowledges self-imposed shame and lowers your restitution, what you have to pay. Very interesting idea. That's his suggestion for why there's a difference between the theft, the price a thief pays to compensate for an ox and a sheep. It has to do with your sacrificing your own human dignity. Okay. Let's see where that takes us. So again, Rabbi Yochanan is not establishing a legal norm. He's giving a reason for a biblical law, but he's suggesting the Torah is so sensitive to the shame that we undergo when we degrade ourselves or when others degrade us, that you actually pay less in the act of degrading yourself, you know, and stealing a sheep. The Yerushalmi, now we're going to take it into the rough and tumble of Talmudic discourse, of halachic discourse. Because what we saw was ethical ideas, educational ideas, principles to live by, this idea that we're created in the image of God. We see that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai tries to find a reason in the Torah for God having compassion on human dignity in his, the demands the Torah makes for restitution, for compensation. The Yerushalmi, the Palestinian Talmud, so if the Tosefta is edited around between 200 and 300 CE, the Yerushalmi is edited a little bit later, 400, a little after 400 CE. There's a statement that Rabbi Zera the Elder sells. Great is the dignity of man, I'll read it in Hebrew first, Gadol kvod abriot shadoche lemitzvah belo taaseh sha'a achat. Rabbi Zera says something that's scandalous. He says if it ever comes to a conflict between human dignity and keeping a mitzvah, observing a mitzvah in the Torah, exerting a command, or transgressing a command in the Torah, human dignity comes first. Now, for religionists, this becomes a bit of a problem, because how can God ask you to do anything? Remember, we're created in the image of God. God demands, God commands. How can there ever be a situation in which observing the will of God or the command of God endangers our human dignity? That's an oxymoron. That can't go together. You can't, how can that work? How could following the will of God endanger my human dignity? There's tension there. How can there even be a conflict? And here comes Rabbi Zera, and he doesn't really even develop the idea in the Yerushalmi, in the Palestinian Talmud. He says, yes, great is the dignity of man, for it overrides a negative commandment in the Torah for 1 hour. In other words, if you're in a situation, I'm just going to be very dramatic here. You're in a situation, and you're out with co-workers, and you end up in a restaurant that's not kosher, and something is put before you, or I'll actually make it even easier for us. You end up at a colleague's house who says to you, I've prepared food for you, and I bought kosher food, and you know the person's house is not kosher, and you're in a situation, and you know they cooked the food with their dishes and their pots. They had no idea what being kosher meant. According to Rabbi Zera, in order to preserve their human dignity, right, because it would be very embarrassing for you to reject their overtures, there might be room to sit down and eat with people who have not served you fully kosher food, or maybe non-kosher food, to preserve theirs and yours dignity. Okay, and after I taught this class and brought several people came over to me to tell me they were in similar situations, and you have to make a decision like this, and it's absolutely about dignity, because when you reject people who have prepared food for you, we all know that moment, it could be very offensive, it could be very humiliating, very hurtful. I'm not giving a halachic psak right now, I'm just giving an example, okay, of situations where Bizera is thinking of that might come up in which someone's dignity is at stake, yours or someone else's, and human dignity is so great, it temporarily overrides a negative commandment in the Torah. The Babylonian Talmud is not so sure that it wants to expand the potential of this principle. Because if I take Rabbi Zera seriously, every person at every moment has different definitions of what their dignity is. We said dignity is actually not egalitarian. It's very subjective. It changes from age to age. What is mortifying to my 15-year-old daughter is hopefully not going to be equally mortifying to me at 25 or at 35 or at 45. What's mortifying to me at my age is going to be different. Very subjective. And so if I take Rabbi Zera seriously, at any moment, if dignity is at stake, I can override a negative commandment. That creates a bit of a balagan, and a bit of a mess. So the Babylonian Talmud is aware of this, and it begins to really think about whether you can override a mitzvah in the Torah, a negative commandment, or ignore a positive commandment, in order to save human dignity. And they come up with the classic example, nakedness. Okay, nakedness, I think we'll all agree, in the wrong place, is the example par excellence of the lack of human dignity. If I find myself unclothed in a situation in which everyone is clothed, that will be extremely shameful. That will be a degradation to my dignity, my body that was created in the image of God, and so on and so forth, unseemly. And so they ask, what happens if someone finds themselves wearing a mix of shatnez, of linen and wool, and they're in the marketplace? And I already tell you, in the Talmud, they don't wear underwear. You're wearing your garment, you're wearing your robe, and you're in the market, this is what they're addressing, and you notice, you look down in horror of horrors, you see a string of linen and wool intertwined. According to the Talmud, the initial response is, you have to rip it off even in the street, even in the public thoroughfare. Why? Because the Gemara quotes a pasuk from Proverbs, Ein chokhma ve'ein tfuna ve'ein etzah l'neged Hashem. There is no wisdom, no understanding, no counsel against the Lord. In other words, God prohibits wearing linen and wool, what's called linsey woolsey. So what if you're naked as a result? I mean, how can there be a conflict between your shame and God's command? So in the very Talmudic way, they never actually answer that question of what to do if you find yourself in the marketplace. I mean, it becomes the example of whether you can override a biblical commandment or not. But they never actually go so far as to illustrate people being undressed in the street. Okay, they go through a long, complicated discourse about situations where it seems that a biblical command is overridden because of human dignity. Each time they deflect it, they say, oh, no, that example, that's a rabbinic example. That example, that's a rabbinic example. And what they come to the conclusion is, and here it is on your source sheet, greatest human dignity since it overrides a negative precept of the Torah. Why should it? Again, they ask, well, there's no wisdom nor understanding nor counsel against the Lord. Rav Bar Shaba explained the dictum and said that you override one negative precept. Look at the bottom, Deuteronomy 17. You shall act in accordance with the instructions given you and the ruling handed down to you. You must not deviate from the verdict that they announced to you, either to the right or to the left. In other words, the one mitzvah in the Torah, the commandment that you're allowed to override, happens to be the one verse that gives rabbinic law its agency. In other words, it's the one verse that essentially grounds rabbinic law as having authority. So by definition, what they're saying is you can override rabbinic laws when there's a conflict with human dignity and rabbinic law, but they do not want to go so far as to say you override biblical law. Okay, so while we had the Yerushalmi that went as far, the Palestinian Talmud that says you can override even a biblical commandment, the Babylonian Talmud says, wait, that's going too far. You can override rabbinic commandments when it comes to human dignity. So if you're wearing rabbinically prohibited shatnez, linen and wool, there's a whole complicated process of how linen and wool become prohibited and when it's biblical and when it's rabbinic. I'm not going to go into it right now. But if you look down and discover your linen and wool is prohibited rabbinically, no need to rip off your clothing. If it's biblical, leaves open the possibility you have to rip off your clothing. So they create a gradation, they create a scale in which rabbinic law can be overridden, biblical law cannot. The last piece, which is just interesting and somewhat important, although we're not going to go into it, they also agree if it comes down to saving face, saving your dignity, and performing a mitzvah, you save face and don't perform the mitzvah. It's what's called sheva al tasa, sit and do nothing. In other words, if you need to go bury a dead body that you find on the road, then as a result, you're not going to bring your Passover offering. And remember, you have once a year, well, you do have a do-over, twice a year in which you can bring your Passover offering. If you're supposed to circumcise your son on the eighth day and you discover a dead body that has to be buried, what's called a mate mitzvah, an unattended corpse. I think we all understand that in addition to nakedness, a dead body that's unattended is the, again, another primary example of lack of human dignity, even though the person is dead, right? We want to honor the dead. You're allowed to defer, push off possibly for a year, certainly miss the deadline for bringing your Passover offering or circumcising. And that's what's called a sheval tasa. So what they do is two things. You override rabbinic law to save face, to preserve human dignity. You do not perform a positive commandment, a mitzvah, to save face and preserve human dignity. Okay, that's more or less where the Babylonian Talmud goes. That's more or less where we got to. Turn the page. One of the ways in which I know that the Talmud is really not going as far as to suggest people take their clothing off in the marketplace is because they never address women. I mean, one of the things I noticed in the context of the whole conversation, if they were really serious about this, they would have to have as a test case women wearing shatnez in the marketplace, because female nakedness poses even more problems than male nakedness in the marketplace of the Talmud. And the fact that they never even go into that conversation suggests to me, and I actually asked other people, that this was only meant to be a theoretical conversation. They did not really entertain the possibility that to keep the Torah, to preserve God's will, people would start running around naked in the marketplace. Okay, and so you have to use some of your own, what we call seichel, right? And take care of the situation at home. From principle to practice. I'm going to skip Rashi right now for lack of time. Now we're going to see some examples. There are really three situations in which the Talmud and the early halachic discourse is concerned: nakedness, the bathroom, and death. Now, if I talked out again, we're created in the image of God. We very much have human bodies. Those human bodies at times expose us to tremendous shame and tremendous degradation. And they pinpoint three really classic examples: being undressed, having to use the bathroom and not being able to clean oneself after the bathroom, and a dead body. Okay, and that's what we're going to see. Ravina was once walking behind Mar, son of Rav Ashi, in the street. On one of the Sabbaths, I'm on page 3, from Principle to Practice, A, Menachot 37b. On one of the Sabbaths preceding the festival, when suddenly a corner of Mar's garment with its fringe had torn away, but Ravina told him nothing about it. So you have two sages walking down the street. At this time, as I said, they wear four-cornered garments, robes, nothing underneath. The four-cornered garments have the fringes of the tzitzit. They don't have what we have today, where you actually go and buy a garment and put it on. Their garments needed, had the obligation of tzitzit on the garment itself. And as he's walking down the street on Shabbat, a corner of Mar's garment tears away, and he's left with only three of the four fringes. And the mainstream opinion in the Talmud is it's not kosher. That basically, essentially, he's wearing a garment that means nothing, meaning you have three fringes instead of four, and it's Shabbat. So it's like you're carrying the fringes on Shabbat because they're no longer a useful part of the garment. And he's in the public thoroughfare. And the question is, what do you do? This is Shabbat. This is a violation of Shabbat. That's a pretty big, you know, it's pretty big command in the Torah. Ravina told him nothing about it. When he came home and Ravina told him that it had turned away, he said, "Had you told me of it, I should then and there have cast it off." So he says, if you had told me, I would have ripped off my garment, which we understand would have been nakedness in the public thoroughfare, which is probably why his friend didn't say anything. "Has not a master said," says Ravina, "great is the dignity of man since it overrides a negative precept of the Torah?" Meaning, don't we have that principle we learned in Brachot, that you can override a negative precept of the Torah? We have it actually from the Palestinian Talmud. Rav Bar Shaba then explained before Rav Kahana that it only means you shall not turn aside from what the rabbis told you. So what's interesting about this piece of Talmud is they're still bringing in the Palestinian Talmud, meaning that Rabbi Zera, who says it overrides any negative prohibition, ends up being brought into this conversation, and it's Rav who explains before Rav Kahana that no, it's only rabbinic. Another version states that Ravina told him of it there in the street, and I like this version better, whereupon Mar said, "Do you think I'm going to cast it off right here and now? Like, why are you telling me this? You should have waited till we got home when I could do something. What am I supposed to do here in the marketplace? Okay, you know, I'll have to suspend my keeping of Shabbat temporarily in order to get home and rectify the situation." And so on. And so the bottom line here is this is where the spoiler alert, when you get to the end of a long passage where you think, oh, I've gotten to a really interesting, innovative idea, they say, well, it's only a rabbinically prohibited space, so the prohibition was only rabbinic. In other words, we thought we were actually bringing in the Palestinian Talmud and allowing this space where you would, you know, override a biblical prohibition, and instead we say, no, 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 it wasn't really a public thoroughfare. It's what's called a carmelite. Again, it has to do with the technicalities of carrying on Shabbat, but that's Menachot 37b. But we see here, again, a test case of a threat to human dignity, to nakedness in public, regardless of how public. We see that we play with this idea, do you override a negative prohibition or not? And we bring it again back to rabbinic prohibition. The next case is very important because it has to do with, okay, you'll see in a minute, Maharam of Rothenburg. We're talking about 1200 in Germany. If one of the fringes falls off, if it is permissible to wrap oneself in one's tallit and make a blessing. Now, from the little bit of research I was able to do, first of all, people are very poor at this time. In addition, you would go to shul on Shabbat, and you would take out your tallit, your tallis, right? Fringed garment that you wrap yourself in, right? What if you get there on Shabbat and you discover one of the frayed fringes had actually torn away? As I said, there's no carrying problem here. There's what's called a muktzah problem. It's something that has no useful purpose on Shabbat because it's no longer a kosher tallis. It's no longer a kosher fringed garment. On the other hand, looking around, everyone's wrapped in their tallitot. If I don't wrap myself in my tallit, it's going to cause questions. People are going to come over to me and say, hey, what happened to you, right? And so the Maharam, that's the question the Maharam has. I show up in shul on Shabbat. I can't do anything about it. I find out my tallit is not kosher. And the one who blesses is taking God's name in vain. Okay, turn the page. Therefore, if a person went to synagogue and found a tallit that had a fringe missing and was not thus fringed properly according to halacha, but is embarrassed to change his custom and sit before the congregation without a tallit, it is possible he would be allowed to wrap himself without a bracha as found in Menachot with regarding rabbinic carmelite for greatest human dignity. In other words, if I allow someone to carry, to continue wearing the three-cornered, the three-fringed garment and walk in a rabbinically prohibited space with a garment that I'm essentially carrying my fringes in, then certainly I should be able to pick up this fringed garment that's muktzah, that again has no inherent value, that's also a rabbinic prohibition, and wrap myself in it to prevent myself from being embarrassed. This is a very different kind of embarrassment. This is not nakedness. I'm fully dressed. It's my shame in front of others that I'm going to stand out, that at the end of shul, someone's going to come up to me and say, hey, why weren't you wearing your tallis? What happened to your tallis? Right? That's embarrassing enough. The Maharam says, pick up the tallis and wrap yourself in. Don't make a blessing. Can't make a blessing. It's not a kosher tallis. But the sensitivity to human dignity, what that means, that sometimes it's purely emotional. I had a friend who I was telling, we were teaching this, she was teaching in Hebrew, I was teaching in English. She said, yeah, her husband doesn't always remember to put on his tallis, and she suffers degradation in the women's section looking down and seeing that he's the only man without a tallis. Now again, that's very, she said, he's not embarrassed, but I'm embarrassed. So these things are very real. Okay, now we're going to get to bathroom. So we took a look at nakedness, and we see that nakedness is definitely grounds for overriding rabbinic prohibition, and I would suggest, because the Talmud doesn't really conclusively say so, that they don't really expect people to rip off shatnez in the marketplace and be naked, certainly not women. He whom Gentiles or an evil spirit, Erevin 41a, have taken out beyond the permitted Sabbath limit, has no more than 4 cubits in which to move. In other words, you have been taken, either Gentiles captured you or an evil spirit, it doesn't really matter. You're beyond the Sabbath limit. And the rule is you're not allowed to move. You can move a very, very limited space, 4 cubits, very limited, that's it, basically until the Sabbath is over. And you have to go to the bathroom. Okay, very human, very real, happens. An inquiry was addressed to Rabbah. What is the ruling where a man had to attend to his needs? Human dignity, he replied, is so important it supersedes a negative precept of the Torah, meaning the precept to follow rabbinic law, and so you can go past the 4 cubits because no one expects you to go to the bathroom where you're standing. In other words, if you're stuck there, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you have another 6 hours until Shabbat is over, you have to go to the bathroom. According to the letter of the law, you should just go wherever you are. You can't move. You can't move more than 4 cubits. But the understanding that confronting your wastes for another 6 hours is humiliating to you, is offensive to you, is enough to allow you to violate rabbinic law and walk into the distance, find a private spot, and go to the bathroom. This is going to continue with, we'll get to toilet paper. That's always the big question. Can you rip toilet paper on Shabbat? I'll get there. Rav Amar Rav Shila asked of Rav Chista, is it permissible to carry stones after one to the roof? I love this question. It's also in Shabbat. Middle of the day, you ran out of stones. In the Talmud, they didn't have toilet paper. They had flat stones. They also suffered terribly from hemorrhoids. Now we can understand why. Not an easy time to be in. Okay. And so you have to go to the bathroom, and you run out of the smooth stones that you've stockpiled for this purpose. And so what you want to do is you want to find a smooth stone downstairs. I mean, you had them stockpiled upstairs where the latrine is or the bucket is or whatever it is you're using. And you don't have any more. And you go downstairs and there are smooth stones. Can you pick up an object? Again, stones are muktzah. Stones cannot be picked up on Shabbat. They serve no purpose. Can you pick them up instead of using it right where you find the stone, which would be the letter of the law? Can you actually pick it up and go upstairs to your private space, to your latrine, so you can be, again, more discreet, more secluded, have privacy, and so on? And the answer is yes, because great is human dignity. In other words, of course, when it comes to human dignity, the bathroom is par excellence. I mean, that's where we want to preserve our dignity for us and for everyone around us. Maremar then reported this discussion, and they ask a very interesting question. Well, what about if I find food stuck in my teeth? That's also a really good example, right? It's also quite embarrassing if you have a big piece of lettuce or spinach in your teeth. Can I take a wood chip I find on the floor, like the stones, something I didn't prepare, something I don't normally use wood chips on Shabbat? And the answer is you can only take it from an animal's trough. And notice the difference here. It's a very interesting difference. The animal's trough is considered to be pre-prepared. Whatever I put into the animal's trough before Shabbat is something I essentially prepared before Shabbat and I can use on Shabbat. Pieces of wood on the floor are considered to not be prepared. So what's the difference between the stone and that I'm allowed to pick up from the floor and the wood chip that I'm not, to clean my teeth, that I'm not allowed to pick up? The difference is you know you're going to eat and you know there's a possibility that food's going to be stuck in your teeth. You cannot possibly know how often you're going to need to go to the bathroom. That's not something you can ever fully prepare for, and as a result, We override the negative commandment to pick up stones on Shabbat, the rabbinic commandment, and allow you to go up to your private spot. But if you end up running out of wood chips in your animal's trough, you should have prepared enough. You knew how many times you were going to eat, and you knew the possibility that you were going to get food stuck in your teeth. So they allow, you know, the stones for the bathroom. They do not allow you to casually pick up wood chips to clean your teeth. Today we have toothpicks. It's a little different. We're always fully prepared for that situation. But notice that, you know, they're not going to allow it to get out of hand. They want to keep it structured. They want it to be within reason. They don't want to give full license anytime anyone feels embarrassed to do whatever they want. And so they have certain categories of discussion. The last example in this is also Shabbat in this section. A dead body was lying in Darukra, which Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak allowed to be carried out into the Carmelite. So we have a dead body on Shabbat. A dead body is muktzah. You're not supposed to move a dead body on Shabbat. You have no use for it. Again, you cover it and you shut the door to the room if it happens. I've known people who have had that situation, and you shut the door to the room and you wait till after Shabbat for the ambulance to come, at least in Israel. I don't know what the law is in America. And here you have a situation where you have a dead body and it's in the house or it's outside in the sun and it's beginning to, rot. And it's beginning to smell. And so it's an interesting question, whose dignity are we preserving? Is it the dignity of the dead? Yes, that's one thing, but he's dead, he or she is dead. Is it the dignity of the living? That again, there's something very degrading, humiliating, offensive in seeing where we all might end up. And so basically, they allow the body to be carried from one reshut, from one, from private space to semi-public space, or from semi-public space to private space, to preserve the dignity, and they don't actually define whose dignity they're preserving. I'll leave you to decide whose dignity. Is it the dead person's? Is it the living people who are being exposed to this? It doesn't really matter, but that's the third category: nakedness, the bathroom, and death. Okay, so that's all very nice, and we've created a very interesting platform, and we understand in extreme situations, you override rabbinic law to preserve human dignity. Very good. The question is, what does this have to do with us today? Can we find any examples beyond these three that expand the scope of the conversation? So to do that, we need to go to the 1500s in Krakow. And now we're going to see social shaming. We did a little bit with the tallit, right, with the maharam, saying you could wrap yourself in a tallit that is not kosher on Shabbat to avoid being socially shamed. But now we're going to see it come full force into the conversation. And it's possible that this example is the first time someone took the principles we've developed and applied them differently, what I'm about to tell you. Okay? Very nice, nakedness, bathroom, death. Oh, I didn't address toilet paper. I'll just give you the short answer. I spent, I think, two classes on toilet paper. Number one, there's no uniformity or if anyone tells you it's asur or it's mutar, it's permitted, it's prohibited, both are grounded in Jewish halachic discourse. From the more, in my opinion, normal Sephardi approach that says you can rip toilet paper on Shabbat and that you might even be able to do it lechatchila, to a really somewhat obscene 18th century response I found that said, if you didn't rip toilet paper before Shabbat, you can according to the law, but we're not going to let you because you should be embarrassed and use your hands and be really embarrassed and never let that happen again. So toilet paper ends up often being a very interesting test case because it's a very, very small conversation that gets very, very big. The answer is if you're in the toilet and you don't have toilet paper, please rip toilet paper. That's okay. Now I'm giving you a psak. I'm giving you halachic ability to rip toilet paper. But there really is no uniformity, and there are a lot of different opinions that range from very extremely stringent to very, very lenient, and that's the way halachic discourse often is. Okay, social shaming. The Shulchan Aruch and Aruch Chaim. We do not betroth on Shabbat. Now, you might think that's obvious. When we talk about betrothed, notice the Hebrew, v'lo mikadshin. So we're not really talking about betrothal or engagement. We're talking about what we today call marriage, kiddushin. We don't do that on Shabbat. Any thoughts why? Well, probably the obvious ones that come to you is there's some sort of contract involved. We don't sign contracts on Shabbat. Another concern is you may come to slaughter extra animals on Shabbat because extra guests come and engage in food preparation that is prohibited. Okay. It's a statement. And the Ramah then adds something astonishing. And there are those who permit kiddushin where the man does not have a wife or children. In other words, if there's a situation where a man has never been married before, does not have any children, an opportunity arises on Shabbat, the Ramah is willing to consider, based on Rabbeinu Tam, a Tosafist, that you could get married. Now, there's an important reason he's saying this. And it is possible this is a law for bringing her into the chuppah, that it is permitted. And even though we do not normally rule this way, we can rely on it for cases of great need, because great is human dignity. And now you think, there's a story here. And what is that story? For it sometimes happens that the dowry was not settled on Friday until the night began, and thus the chuppah and kiddushin are carried out on Friday night. And since they had already prepared for the meal and the wedding, it would be humiliation for the bride and groom if they would not marry, and nonetheless, ideally, it should be avoided. Which already makes those who are curious say, really, just that's a very generic situation? If Friday they're doing the negotiations over the dowry and it's not settled, what's going on here? And so now I'm going to tell you a story, because there's always a story. The Ramah is Rabbi Moshe Isserles. He lives in Krakow in the 1500s. He wrote a code of law but was bumped by the Shulchan Aruch, and he ended up being the commentary in the Shulchan Aruch of Ashkenazi law. It's more than a commentary. It's the code of Ashkenazi law embedded in the Shulchan Aruch, which is the great code of Jewish law studied by rabbis studying for ordination. Okay, and so the Ramah is a major figure of halachic authority and discourse, and even he cannot get away with an innovative ruling, because we are a people who love to question authority. And so even the Ramah is subject to the critique of his colleagues and of his congregation, and it makes you really wonder who does get away with anything. And his name's Moshe, right? So you think Moshe, like Moshe Rabbeinu, no. So he starts off by saying, in the response of the Ramah 125, I didn't bring it to you because it's quite long and I'm only going to paraphrase it. Anyone who wants a copy after can ask me. Voices pass through the camp saying, look at that man Moshe. In other words, I know people are talking about me. And I know it's about a wedding that I arranged in an unusual way on Friday night, an hour and a half after night falls. Meaning he marries a couple on Shabbat. And he says, I want to tell you why I did this. There was a poor man in our land who had betrothed his elder daughter to a suitable mate. They were engaged, not betrothed, engaged. During the period of engagement, which was of considerable duration, the father went to his world and left life to all of Israel. The father died. The daughter was left bereaved without father and mother, except relatives far away. They shut their eyes to her plight. No one wanted to take her in. Again, Krakow in 1500s, Poland is very, very poor. No one wants to take this girl in. She has one relative and uncle from her mother's side who brought her into his house. That's it. Now remember, she's engaged. He settled the engagement before he died. And the time came to prepare the feast, and no one was preparing, no one presented the dowry. No one wanted to pay the dowry. She's a poor orphan, and no one wants to pay the dowry. And the neighbors tell her to go to the mikra, to take the ritual bath, which you do before you get married, and prepare herself for the marriage. And they put her in a veil, as virgins are bedecked. And the shadows of evening begin to fall on Friday. They get married in Poland on Friday because of poverty, because it saves a meal, because you essentially make, you water the soup and you make a few extra pulkies and you invite people to a Shabbat meal together with the wedding feast. Friday is the day Jews get married in Poland, just like Sunday is the day Christians get married. And basically she's there and it's getting late and the relatives who were to give the dowry refuse to give the dowry, and a third of the dowry, they give some, they don't give all, and the groom refuses to marry her. He pays no attention to the leaders, he pays no attention to the Ramah, who comes personally to plead on the behalf of this orphaned virgin. And basically, the time drew on, and there's no marriage settlement without dispute, and finally they agreed, but it's Shabbos. You're not supposed to get married on Shabbos. But he writes here that he understands it's a matter of urgency, because first of all, she's been humiliated enough. If we wait until Sunday, Jews can't get married on Sunday. It means they have to get married on Monday. So you're going to make her wait until Monday. Who knows what's going to happen? In addition, she's sitting here and the veil is on her head, and if this is called off, and it's like teetering here, it's so fragile, if it's called off, she'll never get married, he says. Everyone's going to remember this humiliation, the virgin bride who never made it to the altar. This will ruin her chances. She's an orphan. Who's going to marry her? And so he uses halachic precedent. He brings Rabbeinu Tam, who says, if a man's never been married and doesn't have children, there's room to permit. You bring the smog. He says, in times of great need, you're permitted to marry on Shabbat. Meaning he brings, in principle, halakhic precedents that have never been used in practice. That's what's astonishing about the Ramah. And then he adds human dignity. Great is human dignity. And he says, why am I doing this? And then he says something very funny. Yeah, a little humor. He says, sometimes 5 or 6 chuppot are carried out in one day. And let's be honest, when we say Baruch Hu, that's not when Shabbat starts. Just because Maariv sometimes starts in Atmei, you know, the big criteria is Baruch Hu, which is the beginning of the evening prayer. It's not up to the congregation to decide when Shabbat is. And so, you know, you've been kind of fooling yourself, getting in that last chuppah, the 6th one of the day, and saying, no, we haven't said Baruch Hu yet. We haven't started the evening prayers yet. It's not Shabbos. He says, Shabbos starts when Shabbos starts. It has nothing to do with your evening prayers. And you know what? I took the two of them, and I married them, and I don't regret it. And it was the right thing to do. And thus says Moshe, and so on and so forth. But if you think he got away with it, he didn't, because they made a rule in Krakow not to allow anyone to get married on Friday anymore for the next period of time. The Mordechai writes it. So even the Ramah, who does something so brilliant, so sensitive, so insightful, so based on halachic discourse, it's too innovative. But it remains in the, it makes its way into the Shulchan Aruch. He has the last laugh, so to speak. He brings the story into the Shulchan Aruch. It remains on the books. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, 500 years later, ends up saying, if the Ramah could do that, I could do this. And he uses it as, you know, if we got that far, we can continue on. Okay. What I want to look at next, just to show you where Kvod HaBriot shows up, another interesting scenario, just to tell you things are very interesting in Eastern Europe. The Noda Yehuda, who lives in, I think it's Prague?
Prague,
yes. He lives in Prague. He this case, really, every time I tell it, I'm blown away. It has to do with a young yeshiva student who's had an affair with his hostess, a married woman, for several years. And then he goes and marries her daughter. Okay, so just in case you're not following, he's boarding. He's a yeshiva student who's boarding with a family. And he marries, he has an affair with the married wife, the matron of the house, and he marries her daughter. And then he does tshuva. And he sends a question to his rabbi. Does he have to tell his Shviger is the father-in-law? Am I getting that right? Shver is the father-in-law. Shviger is the mother-in-law. Does he have to tell his Shver? Does he have to tell his father-in-law? Why? Because a man is not supposed to stay with his wife, according to Jewish law, if she's been unfaithful. And he knows his mother-in-law has been unfaithful. And now he has a burning desire to repent and to atone. And he feels the need to tell his father-in-law so that his father-in-law not continue to be married to his mother-in-law. Which, again, the zealousness of the young yeshiva student is just a little much to swallow, given what this is going to do to his wife. Not only that, we find out all the sons are Rashi Yeshiva. The father's the head of a yeshiva. You're talking about a very rabbinic family. This is going to be extremely embarrassing, humiliating to them. But he also understands, I think, it's a very long response, that the mind, the emotions of a penitent, it's very hard to tell them not to do something they're determined to do. He basically, in the course of the response, explains why there would be no reason to tell the father-in-law. There's room to just ignore the whole thing completely. But I think he also understands, it seems to me, that you've got to give this young man something because he's suffering. And when people suffer and want to atone and repent, they feel they have to, you know, they have to tell. He writes here, by the way, in the bold, Umishum kvod abriot, because of human dignity, the tremendous blight this is going to cast on the family. Rashaya bal tshuva liyot b'sheva al tasa shelo lo odia. He basically says this young bal tshuva, this penitent, really could sit and do nothing, meaning he doesn't have to go and atone and confess. It's really not a good idea. But he understands essentially that there's no way of dissuading him. And what basically he suggests is twofold, depending on what the penitent wants to hear. One is to go to the husband and basically say something to the effect, I've heard your wife is having affairs or has had an affair. And then let the husband decide how he wants to. I've heard a rumor that your wife has been sleeping around. That's one thing he throws out. And then he also suggests in the course of his tshuva that it's unlikely the husband has no idea. And that it's very possible the husband has already sexually separated from his wife years earlier. That's the real prohibition, to sleep with your wife if she's been unfaithful. And he says, I have no doubt that the husband essentially has already separated and is just living in a platonic relationship so as not to embarrass the wife and the family. And he says, if you want to, you can tell him very discreetly and very privately that it was you. But like, by no means go to the court. Like, and then he says to him, and if you want to fast and, you know, do penance and so on for the rest of your days, this was a very big sin and you transgressed and you need to do so. But his initial, one of the strongest lines is, because of quota briot, human dignity, and this is not just to the woman, this is really to the wife, to the children, to the husband, sheva al tasa, sit and do nothing. Now, if you think this is, I mean, this is unique, but a question comes before Rav Ovadia Yosef that has... It's similar, different but similar. Two Balei Tshuva get married. They come back and they become Orthodox after having been non-Orthodox. And the question comes up, here it is. I was asked regarding a woman who in her youth as a single woman lived with a man and became pregnant. You don't have this either. I'm just going to paraphrase. It was very short. I had to save room. And when she realized she was pregnant, she went and had an abortion. And then she became very religious and married a yeshiva student. And they lived together with love and peace, and she became pregnant and had a son. The problem is the husband thinks it's a firstborn son. So he thinks he gets to fulfill the mitzvah, the positive commandment of redeeming the firstborn. This is not the only tshuva like this, but apparently, I believe this was in Be'er Sheva, and the rabbi did not know how to handle it. It makes its way to Rav Ovadia Yosef, who's the only one who can handle questions like this. And basically, the wife knows this is not her firstborn child. She knows that she has had an abortion, which essentially, if you have a miscarriage or an abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, you can no longer redeem the firstborn. Your womb has been used, so to speak. And so basically, the husband is all ready to fulfill his mitzvah. He didn't know his wife had an abortion. He didn't think she was a virgin, I want to point that out, meaning it's not that she deceived him about her past, but he never asked her. And she never told. And they lived together in peace and harmony. And she asked the rabbi if she had to tell her husband so he didn't make a blessing in vain. And essentially, it's deceptive. They're deceiving all these people. And if he finds out what happened, the rabbi has no idea what to do. It makes its way up, as I said. In a panic, he sends it out. Someone told me they knew the story personally. It gets up to Rav Ovadia, and basically Rav Ovadia says, what, are you kidding me? Of course you don't say anything. Sheva al tasa, just sit and do nothing. She should not tell her husband. This is not a, this will lead to no good. This will be absolutely humiliating for her. And it will cause, who knows, endless strife. It could be for him abortion, that would be the last. He totally gets it. And he uses the Nota Biuda. He quotes a semblance. You see, he builds on the Nota Biuda. So you see that what we're seeing from a very, again, we started with a very grand conversation about being created in the image of God. We narrowed it to very particular situations in which the body is degraded, the body is humiliated, nakedness, bathroom, burial, and so on, my body, myself. And we've now expanded it to the social realm, where what other people think about us, what happens to us in terms of society, is very important in terms of our quota briot, in terms of our dignity. So those are just some very beautiful examples of how that plays out. Okay. What I want to now take it to in the time that I have left, and I don't have a lot of time left, is, okay, so what? Can we use this more broadly? Where can we use it? And the two main conversations today really are with LGBT community and with women and partnership, women in synagogue. Okay, and so what I want to do first is bring some reflections of Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, who was one of the foremost modern Orthodox thinkers. He died 2 years ago and left a tremendous imprint on modern Orthodoxy and halachic thinking. And in a very long paper he wrote, which he published, it took him 40 years to publish, which showed how long he struggled with whether to publish this or not. Unfortunately, basic halachic sources, page 6, provide only limited guidance. At most, they supply us with raw material, but
page
not
seven.
With...
Page 7.
Oh, page 7, I'm sorry. I have two different source sheets going on here. Oh, I skipped the Tzitz Eliezer. I can't see. Okay, let me just tell you what he said. He was asked a question about wearing hearing aids on Shabbat, whether a deaf person would be allowed to, or someone hard of hearing, would be allowed to wear hearing aids. Hearing aids in the 1970s are not quite the same as hearing aids today, and there's an issue of carrying. And so, basically, if you notice, he says so beautifully, again, if you're, it seems that on the bottom of the page, page 6, there is no greater use of the principle of human dignity than in the case of the deaf person when he comes to synagogue and he cannot hear and he is alone in his silence and he cannot answer those who talk to him, and this causes a greater infliction to his human dignity than other cases, and so on. In addition to humiliation, there is pain at being cast out, and so on and so forth. And he says it is well to allow the carrying of muktzah for human dignity and thus allow the deaf person to carry a hearing aid on Shabbat. That's a totally different expansion of human dignity. I will say hearing, seeing eye dogs comes up into the conversation as well. And tattoos, whether women can tattoo eyeliner or tattoo, again, tattoos are biblically prohibited. But the question is, again, women who undergo chemotherapy or have all sorts of scars from surgery, whether we can tattoo to preserve their human dignity. And very interesting conversations, and the answers are largely yes, largely because it's brought down to the rabbinic place, not to the biblical place. But okay, I didn't have a chance to really do that. Page 7. Unfortunately, basic halachic sources here provide only limited guidance. At most, they supply us with raw material, but not with definitions proper. As regards quota briot, human dignity, the Gemara cites only a few instances, ensuing prompt and proper burial of a corpse, personal hygiene, and dignity as related to the function of excretion, and the avoidance of disrobing in public. We've seen these. These are all fairly drastic circumstances. Collectively, they would set a standard restricting the license of quota briot to a very few situations indeed. Nevertheless, it is possible that the concept may be construed more broadly. Several tentative guidelines come to mind readily. First, personal dignity must be significantly, albeit briefly, fractured rather than merely ruffled. Secondly, genuine dignity must be involved, not superficial vanity. The avoidance of any and every frivolous hurt can hardly override an injunction, and so on and so forth. Okay, what I want to skip down to is the last paragraph. Our attempt to define quota briot and shalom has not arrived at a truly precise formulation on which one could be readily applied at a practical level. Whatever the exact definitions, however, one point seems fairly clear. The dispensations warranted by these factors have not been sufficiently recognized. Wherever any reasonable line may be drawn, we have collectively strayed far on the side of caution. Precisely because these concepts are so amorphous and their applications so potentially sweeping, post-game halachic authorities have generally been reluctant to resort to them as grounds for overriding halachic norms. Their reluctance is thoroughly understandable. Inasmuch as these concepts lend themselves to widespread and dangerous abuse, one naturally tends to stifle even their legitimate application. No doubt in the modern period particularly, as organized attempts at the irresponsible manipulation of halakha have actually materialized, the urge to tone down elements that in reckless hands could undermine its entire structure has become almost irrepressible. Nevertheless, this conservatism, however laudable in motive intent, is not without its dangers. Elements such as quota briot and shalom, or as peace, are central to a Torah Weltanschauung, a fact to which their legitimate and limited role in suspending certain halakhic norms clearly attests. Yet the reluctance to permit them to play that tends to downgrade their position. The result, and he goes on, you get the idea. The last line, some margin of safety is perhaps advisable, but must it be as large as we have tended to maintain? And so what he does here is really again say, we have this wonderful principle that has been applied in practice, but we've kept it very, very small and very, very narrow out of our fear for the slippery slope. And believe me, he is very aware of the slippery slope. He talks about irresponsible halachic decision-making. On the other hand, he doesn't think that gives it license to stop the use of this principle completely, the application of this legal principle completely. And he actually speaks quite strongly. What I want to bring you are two examples that I'm sure Rav Lichtenstein would question as possibly being halachically reckless. Okay, this, I think, is part of what he's afraid of. I've taught, in the course of that class I taught at Matan, I spent several classes on partnership minyan. I have to say that I read the arguments in both directions. I think it is there are halakhic tools to permit, and I think until it becomes mainstream, it's right now a religious struggle, a struggle for is this going to become part of the religious, you know, conversation, or is it going to remain on the outside? I think both camps make kind of compelling halakhic arguments. That's okay. I said with toilet paper, there are some who prohibit and some who absolutely permit. I'm all for discourse and non-uniformity and disagreement. That's fine. I think Rabbi Daniel Sperber wrote a very important paper called Congregational Dignity and Human Dignity. And one of the things in which he argues, what he does here is astonishing because he does two things. Number one, he wants to move it, what he's about to say, from temporary to permanent, and he wants to do it to an entire institution, to the synagogue, because of human dignity. Okay, we're going to see in a minute what he writes. A few years ago, in speaking at a conference of the Jofa, I said that changes happen continually, and that they are accepted when they occur organically, step by step, slowly free of undue aggressiveness. There are thousands of women studying Torah and Talmud in Israel, the United States, and Europe. There are rabbinic toanot, those are pleaders who work in the rabbinic courts. There are accepted women decisors in the area of Nida. And even though Maimonides seems to say women may never be granted any halakhic authority or communal position, women now sit on all sorts of committees and councils, including Israeli regional religious affairs councils. They recite Kaddish, the mourner's prayer, consistent with the rulings of Rav Soloveitchik and others, and they become more and more involved in every aspect of religious and ceremonial life. All this has taken place in one generation, and I believe that a community that has made such change possible and done so for proper motives and not in imitation of the heretics will not remain outside of the consensus and will not come to be considered non-orthodox after a generation, for the consensus itself will change. These changes take place in accordance with the true stream of halakhic development, which has always throughout the generations taken account of changing situations, changing social conditions, and changing needs. What may have been a reasonable cause for concern in the 70s may no longer be significant in the present decade, and what may not have been a consideration 30 years ago, one may now be a critical factor. And these are legitimate and accepted considerations in the world of halakha in general, bearing special weight in connection with emotional issues of the sort here under discussion. It seems to me that nowadays in those communities where it is agreed that change within the normative halakhic framework should take place, and that the absence of such change will be a source of pain and suffering to an important segment of the community, the principle of quod habriot overcomes the stated principle of quod et cibor. What he's saying here is the principle of human dignity overrides a negative prohibition, overrides rabbinic law. He wants to expand it to the rabbinic laws, really even more, the communal customs of gender separation in the synagogue. What he's essentially saying is the halakhic disqualification of women from reading Torah or from leading services, it's a very small conversation in the Talmud. One of the statements is a congregational honor. And he says when we weigh human dignity, the dignity of mankind, versus congregational honor, which is very limited to the congregation, there should be room to bring in this, because we're only in the rabbinic strata anyway. in order to override the way synagogue has been structured and prayer has been practiced for the last 2,000 years. It was a very far-reaching statement. I think he does have a compelling argument. I think there is room to continue discussing this. I think that, again, it's in the rough and tumble of halachic discourse right now. What's going to change is if there's enough bottom-up, meaning if enough congregations adopt partnership minyan, which for the purpose of this evening is mechitza, with women leading services that do not require 10 men, and reading Torah, that's more or less what we're talking about. I think if it becomes mainstream or widespread enough, it'll become accepted into the halachic discourse, as many of these things do. Halacha often works bottom-up and top-down. What the people do, what the rabbis order, when the rabbis authorize. Sometimes the rabbis don't authorize something, and the people do it anyway. And that's always very interesting. And then it becomes, well, the people are doing it, so we have to allow it. I think this is one of those moments where halacha is not going to give us the answer. The halachic discourse has tools to permit. I think Rabbi Sperber is sensitive to the fact that human dignity is at stake within congregations and communities and families, and that's why he wrote what he did. And I think he wrote it in such a way to allow others to continue formulating the conversation. So that's one piece I want to bring up that is definitely trying to continue what the Rama was trying to do, much broader on a communal, congregational level, permanent, not temporary. We'll see. It's still in process. Many things have been written on top of it. The last piece I want to bring up, which is also a source of tremendous conversation, and again, I'm sorry this is only at the end, but in order to really even understand why this is relevant, I had to bring you 2,000 years of halachic discourse, which is what we did. This is from a response of the conservative movement. I'm sorry, I don't remember when it came out. It was sometime in the 2000s. And it talked about the human dignity of homosexuals. And what the conservative movement did, and what I'm going to compare it to, is a statement of principles of Orthodox Jews, or the Yeshiva University community in the bottom, to show, you know, again, the difference, the really two different approaches to human dignity. Rabbi Louis Ginsburg discusses the concept of Kvod HaBriot, human dignity, in his commentary on Rushalmi. Rabbi Ginsburg states, the law is more sensitive to the humiliation of the individual than to the disrespect to the public. This commentary supports our understanding that Kvod HaBriot describes the dignity of an individual within his or her social context. Dignity is a social phenomenon, which is why it's not egalitarian. We are concerned for the dignity of gay and lesbian Jews not only because we are sympathetic to their dilemma, because also their humiliation is our humiliation. We wish to welcome them, but we do so in such a forbidding fashion that they are repeatedly humiliated. Looking at our own congregations, we too are embarrassed by our cold welcome. When gay and lesbian Jews are finally welcomed to take their rightful places in our community, then we will have safeguarded their dignity as individuals and our dignity as a community. For the contemporary posek, halachic authority, to possess this information, to hear the distress of gay and lesbian Jews eager to observe the Torah and simply to state that nothing could be done, is to ignore the halachic principles of human dignity. Until this point, halachic authorities have maintained a complete ban on all intimate acts by homosexuals, okay? As we have shown, the Kvod HaBriot principle supersedes rabbinic, not biblical law. So again, they're within the conversation that I presented tonight. Of course, there's a theoretical way to overturn biblical law via what's called takana, decree. We do not find this mechanism to be appropriate in our case because takana requires the consent of the majority, okay? However, the rabbinic restrictions upon gay men and lesbian women that result in a total ban on all sexual expression throughout life are in direct conflict with the ability of these Jews to live in dignity as members of the people of Israel. For this reason, the principle, halachic principle of Gadol Kvod HaBriot, greatest human dignity, must be invoked by the CJLS to relieve their intolerable humiliation. Okay, that's an example. They took the principles we've been developing all night, the conversation, the idea that we are all created, Kvod HaBriot, all created in the image of God, regardless of sexuality, regardless of gender, right? And they apply that here both as an ethical teaching, as an educational principle, as a halachic principle, and they still restrict it. They say, look, we're not coming to overturn biblical law here. We know the Babylonian Talmud did not allow that, but nonetheless, there's an enormous scope within which we can operate. I'll just compare it because a statement of principles that I signed in 2010 used human dignity, but they used it much more narrowly, which again shows that it's continuously going to reflect the halachic discourse within any given denomination and community. We, the undersigned Orthodox rabbis, heads of yeshiva, ramim, Jewish educators, communal leaders, and so on and so forth, affirm the following principles. So there were something like 11 principles. I only brought you one. All human beings are created in the image of God and deserve to be treated with dignity and respect. We're back to Ben Azai at the very beginning. We're back to this idea that people need to be respected because they are created in the image of God. Every Jew is obligated to fulfill the entire range of mitzvot between person and person in relation to persons who are homosexual and have feelings of same-sex attraction. Embarrassing, harassing, or demeaning someone with homosexual orientation or same-sex attraction is a violation of Torah prohibitions that embody the deepest values of Judaism. I will say that was an enormous step in Orthodoxy. I know it's not enough for many people who are struggling to find their place within the Jewish community. They then went on throughout the principles to talk about the fact that they're not coming to validate halakhically any sort of behavior, but they did talk about giving LGBTs aliyahs, gay members of the community, aliyot to the Torah. They talked about behavior. They talked again. They removed it from the halakhic conversation. They weren't going to make any halakhic decisions, but they applied it in the way Rambam applies it. They applied it in the way Ben Azai talks about the greatest principle in the Torah, which is great is human, great is the fact that we're created in the image of God. And they started with that. That was the first principle. So again, I wanted to bring both voices, one which took the principle of quota briot further into the social and halachic domain, one that brought it into the social domain cautiously, carefully. And I would say in the last 7 years, a lot of work has been done within all the denominations, but particularly within Orthodoxy, in trying to really emphasize and educate towards quota briot in the full meaning of the phrase, respecting one another. So I just want to finish off. We've seen a lot. Hopefully you managed to follow. We've seen a lot. We've seen a lot of different ideas. We've seen a halachic, really an ethical concept being integrated into halachic discourse. We've seen it move from the individual to society, to both social structures and also, disability. What happens when I have a disability and how can I come to synagogue and remain part of the community? And then I brought two final examples, which are really still being studied and developed and evaluated on whether quota briot can be expanded. Let me just say, may we all continue to develop our own quota briot. May we all remember that continuously when we teach, when we interact with people, when we lead within our families, within our communities, so that we can take Ben Azai very seriously, that essentially the first and most important principle of the Torah, let us all act as if we're created in the image of God. Thank you very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.